Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Doug Kelly, your host. Welcome to Paranexus Universe. Here with my co-host Grant Rubendunst. Hey, Grant.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. Happy Thursday night.
Yeah, today is Thursday, October 30, 2008. Tomorrow night is Halloween, and we just got done with the Paranexus conference last weekend, and it was a great time. We had a number of great speakers. We did a table tipping that night. It was a very educational experience. Grant spoke, as did several other Paranexus members. It was a good time, don't you think, Grant?
Oh, absolutely. We had a wonderful time. It was great being able to meet all the folks that were new to Paranexus, folks that came for the conference. It was wonderful networking with them. We had a great costume party. Kevin Costa, one of our members out of Miami, had one hands down with his Victorian ghost, which was a real hoot. So yeah. It was a lot of fun, and got to meet some really nice people.
Yeah, and it was, well, we hope to do it again. We're going to wait to see how the economy does and plan it for a little bit of a better time on the economy, because I think that was one of the reasons why a lot of folks couldn't join us. So we appreciate all the speakers that presented on Saturday. We appreciate everybody who joined us at the conference and online for the broadcast, and we look forward to seeing you all again soon. Now, tonight, we have with us Scott Marlowe. He is from the Pangea Institute, one of the co-founders. We're going to be talking about hairy monsters of myth and legend, and let me just give you a little bit of background on Scott. He studied education at Polk County Community College, majored in the social sciences at Rollins College. He spent two summers in the early 1970s in Europe studying art and design with the Cochrane Group and attended the 1977 summer design program at Harvard School of Continuing Education. Between educational assignments, Scott traveled the world extensively pursuing paleontology, archaeology, and cultural disciplines. His extensive field work experience gave his academic understanding considerable depth and a strong appreciation of practical hands-on instruction in combination with conventional classroom learning. Scott began teaching in 1978. His first teaching position was instructing art and design in the adult education program for Fairfax County, Virginia at Thomas Edison High School. By 1980, Scott was teaching design at the Northern Virginia Community College, Loudoun County campus. In 81, Scott began teaching continuing education courses for the Professional Golfers Association of America. Scott continues to accept speaking and educational assignments for the PGA and other professional organizations. And a little bit on what he's done more recently. In mid-2003, Scott began working on a course concept for cryptozoology to be taught through Pangea Institute in the Virtual Academy. Scott had been working quietly in the cryptids field for over 30 years, collecting and analyzing accounts of strange animal encounters and legends about enigmatic creatures from his travels. As plans for the course began to take shape, it became apparent that the venue originally chosen for the program would be inadequate to do the material justice. In the summer of 2004, Scott approached the Florida Keys Community College with the curriculum for the cryptozoology class. His approach to the subject matter was scientific objectivity and emphasis on the science and not the cryptid animals themselves won the college's approval for the program. It would become the college's first internet-delivered course and the first college-level cryptozoology program in the world. His accomplishment was hailed in cryptozoology circles around the world, with news of the course being named one of the 10 most important achievements in 2004. And Scott, thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's great to have you.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, a lot of stuff you've done. And we were chatting just a little bit earlier. How did you get into all this?
I started out as a pre-med major, believe it or not. I've always been strong in the sciences. And while I, you know, I guess like most pre-med dropouts, wound up in sociology, came home one night. At the time, I was living in an apartment complex off of 436 in Orlando, which at that point, you know, this is back in the really early 70s. That was about as far out as you could get short of goldenrod, and was extremely rural. And I came home one night, got this strange feeling after stopping by a Publix to pick up some groceries. It was dark. It was about this time of year. And I got this feeling I was being watched, but I didn't see anything, didn't smell anything, I might hastily add. And went over to the passenger side of my MGB GT, picked up my bag of groceries, and stood up. And then I saw this hairy thing standing outside of the light coming from a lamppost at the edge of our parking lot over by the dumpsters.
Really?
And I froze. I knew what a Bigfoot was, but I didn't expect to see anything like that in Florida. I didn't even know they were here at that point.
At Publix.
And, Swamp Ape, as I've come to call them over here. But froze for a minute, our eyes locked. I could see the eyes, and I could see the hair, but not much else. And after a short time, though I was scared to death, of course, I'm in my, early 20s. The thing
that was like, 10 years ago?
Oh, good God, no. I wish. This is almost, I guess, almost 35 years ago now.
Dude, I was trying to suck up here. Come on.
I wish I could go back to about 25. I'll tell you, if I knew what I knew now was 25, I'd be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Oh, me too.
But in any case, started backing up very slowly, which is about all my feet were going to do at that point. And I was on the second floor apartment and went up the stairway backwards and keeping this thing in sight, and it stayed there the whole time. Then I got to the upper landing, turned around long enough to put the key in the door with, setting the bag down. And when I turned back around, it was gone. And being a pre-med major and having had some experience with anatomy and what have you, I had a pretty good idea what I was looking at. And I knew it was not a typical human-type thing. It was definitely not wearing clothes, and it was definitely hairy. You could see the outline of the irregular hair, the matted hair, and all of that, in the shadow of the animal. So, but I got really weird vibrations from it. It was almost as though it didn't expect to see what it saw, and the complex was brand new then. It was kind of a strange encounter. And I never said a word because I was scared to death at that time that the public wasn't ready for it, and that if I went public, I would destroy any hope of a career. So I didn't do anything until I got to the point, of course, I collected all this stuff, as you said, very quietly as I went along and filed it away. But basically collected the stuff until I finally decided, I've got no more bridges to build, and I really don't care if I burn any. So I went public.
Well, cool. So do you think that the Swamp Ape was there getting some groceries, or?
It probably was raiding the dumpster or planning on it. After that, I heard stories about the thing smelled to high heavens, and they had some sightings back in that time frame that made the newspaper. They were mostly over in the Brooksville area about that time. But so the animal was evidently fairly active, and I just started collecting information. And it wasn't until Animal X came out on, I think it was History Channel, and Chris Stevens and Chester Moore, who are now really nice friends of mine, they're great people, invited me out to the APCA conference in Conroe, Texas, unbeknownst to me, to give me an award for teaching the class that year. And then gave several of my students awards, including Lisa Wojcik, who's one of my colleagues now, a Pangea fellow. So they took me out to the places where they had taken the Animal X crew, and we had not a blob squatch, but a face through the leaves kind of sighting that was there and then wasn't when I went out with Chester in an area, in the big thicket. And then they took me out later that night. And that was a classic situation that night when Chris was finally able to join us. We went out to an area that's very, very secret that Chester knows. And from the time we got out of the vehicles near a bridge by the bayou and all of that where all of this took place, you could tell there was something there because, boy, I'll tell you, it smelled like the rear end of a seafood restaurant on a hot summer day. And, I mean, it was really bad. And the smell came and went and came and went and came and went, and we finally realized we were being paced, and there was a family of them behind. It's kind of hard to explain. The bayou was on our right as we headed in, and there were these large Mogul hills that you couldn't see over on the left, and there was only one path going in. And when we got back to where Chester said during daylight we'd have hit cane fields where they were evidently feeding, things got a little hectic. I turned around. We had infrared equipment and all of that. And I turned around to talk to Chester for a moment and take a scope because I thought something was in front of us. And I had no sooner turned around than I got beamed on the back of the head with a stick.
Really?
And at first I thought that it was just crap falling out of the canopy of the trees. And then I realized, no, it couldn't possibly be because I was wearing a wide brim hat and it hit me up under the hat. So it had to come from the ground level.
Wow.
And that was really freaky. And then, of course, Chester told me the next day that that wasn't unusual. The same thing had happened to his father, only it was a much bigger piece of wood in the same spot. Chris was freaking out a little bit, and Chester, we all got a little bit nervous because we evidently were getting them upset. We did have the conference the next morning, so rather than stick around, we left, and I really wish we hadn't. I'd have liked to have pushed on, but on the way back, I apparently had some sort of a pheromone reaction because, if I can handle an autopsy or a necropsy, there's very little that's going to upset my stomach. And yes, right. I'm diabetic, and yes, I can have blood sugar issues, but I tested my blood sugar the minute I got back to the car to see if that was the cause of it, and it wasn't. I got extremely nauseated.
Really?
But these things apparently were closing in on us to see that we left. Chester, I think, caught more of a glimpse of it than I did. When he gave me his passive infrared scope, I could see between these two enormous trees a body moving back and forth and kind of peeking out from behind the trees in that eerie blue, green light.
Wow.
So it was kind of weird. And I guess I'm one of the few people that's been lucky enough to, quote, see these animals three times. Albeit in different geography. So people ask me, how does that happen? And, well, I don't know, but I do know this. If I want to go looking for a shark, I don't look in my bathtub. You got to look in the places they are. So that's one of the things you just got to bear in mind.
One of the things that's always fascinated me, and maybe you can kind of clarify for us, Scott, is that odor that that seems to be characteristic. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that don't some of the larger primates emit a similar odor when they're stressed or when they feel threatened? And
all
do you think
them.
That that's okay? So obviously there must be some sort of similarity. And then when these creatures are also stressed, they have a similar sort of, is it like a defense mechanism?
Well, it could be several things. First of all, in male primates, pheromones, which a lot of people don't know much about, are carried in their sweat, whereas with females, it's in their urine.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we could smell the thing is what led me to believe that what I had was some sort of a reaction to the pheromones when I got nauseated and literally had to put my head down because I was just, losing it. Uh, and uh, you know, we got back to the highway, and you know, and I sat down for a while, and I was okay. But the until we actually got out of the area, it didn't subside. And like I said, I know it wasn't blood sugar. There was no way that I was sick. I had no problem. There was no flu. There was no reason for it whatsoever. The next day I'm standing up getting an award. I got a whole, this stuff went on for hours and hours and hours that day. So if I'd been sick, I'd have certainly known it. It was, it's just the weirdest thing. I mean, that's the only time I actually smelled something. I think it's just because there had to be a quantity of them, and we were making them very nervous. They weren't just curious. They were nervous that we were there.
Here's a question from the chat room from Sharon. You mentioned matted fur. She asked, don't primates groom themselves and keep from having mats?
Generally, they do, unless they get out of water. They will groom themselves afterwards as the fur dries. But I think, given where I was and given the geography in 75 of where this took place, this thing probably came out of the water. I'm sure the swamp ape uses waterways as their highway. They don't walk down the street.
Is that something that larger primates, I don't ever recall seeing in any of the National Geo shows or anything, seeing primates take to water. So are they pretty comfortable in water, Scott?
Well, a lot of people say chimps don't swim. That's nonsense. I can send you a photo of a chimp doing exactly that. It actually looks like it's doing the Australian crawl. They don't want to drown, and they want to know how deep it is. And there now has been recently some observations where gorillas have used sticks to test the depth of a creek before they cross it, which of course is tool use also.
Right.
The idea that they're afraid of water, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. That they see it as a barrier, possibly. That some of them are intelligent enough to use it as a highway, probably.
Mm-hmm. And also,
particularly, bear in mind, you've got several primate species like the Oreopithecus that lived in an aquatic environment or a semi-aquatic environment. When I say aquatic, don't jump to conclusions, folks. I'm not talking about a dolphin. It doesn't mean that it swims out 20 miles from shore. It means that they live near the swamps, and they spend part of their time in water.
And the throwing of the sticks and, in some cases, stones, that's also the larger primates do that as well, don't they, as well as chimps?
That's very common behavior in an orangutan. It's chimps do it, gorillas do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a situation, and I love the gorillas over at the Animal Kingdom at Disney. I would go over and watch them all the time. But there's an incident that happened at Disney where a guest made one of the male gorillas extremely upset, and it grabbed fecal matter and tossed it rather strongly at the guest. They're well known for doing things like that.
I saw that happen at the Detroit Zoo when I was a kid, where it just picked up a handful and threw it. We had a plexiglass window between us, and there was a large group of people there, and it really upset it. And, wow, that scared the living bee-you-know-what out of everybody, because it went wham against the plexiglass. And
that's all well and good. Getting things thrown at you is all cool, as long as you don't get beamed, in any kind of a really detrimental way. Mm-hmm. But I'd be more concerned if one charged me, although charges are usually false charges. They have a tendency to try and threaten more so than actually have a confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that is true for Bigfoot as well?
Well, it's certainly going to, assuming that everybody's right in their presumption that we are looking at some sort of a primate, it would certainly inherit some primate behaviors.
Do you think we are looking at a primate?
I think it's virtually certain. From the tracks that I've seen that I consider to be genuine, and that includes the ones that have dermal ridges that Jimmy Chilcott has judged, mm-hmm. being some sort of valid primate, and not the flat tracks that everybody's trying to pass off all the time. And you having taken my course there, Doug, you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
I believe that it has to be. And it also has to be a fairly near relative for one reason and one reason only. Based on the tracks alone, five parallel toes are indicative of hominins.
So relative to us.
Yes, they have to be related to us. All other higher apes have an opposable big toe.
But not this one.
Not this one.
Right.
So it must be a human relative if the tracks are to be believed.
Do we ever is there any evidence in the archaeological record that we cohabitated or habitated in close proximity possibly with these creatures at an earlier stage in our own development or evolution?
Well, that would depend entirely upon what they are. If we're looking at a relic hominin, as the tracks suggest, there was a time in the distant past that Homo sapiens sapiens, or Homo sapiens in general, cohabitated with as many as 4 different human species.
How far back, Scott?
Well, you're going about over 35,000 years.
Uh-huh. And was that
50,000 years?
Was that in Asia, Europe, or pretty much well distributed?
Yeah, well, they were distributed around the world, but Homo erectus apparently didn't die out till about just before the according to the fossil record, to just before the advent of the Neanderthals, or around the same time that they emerged. We know we were out with Neanderthals. There's some equivocation over Homo ergaster, and now we don't know yet whether Homo floresiensis is a separate species or actually part of the Homo erectus family, which would then probably also include Meganthropus, which was a giant version, as with the floresiensis being a diminutive version. And then there's other finds that have taken place in Spain and Grandolina, and some new fossil finds that have been categorized, but they're still working on seeing how that fits into the human taxonomy. There were a number of different species out there, and that all apparently died out, but I'm not convinced that all of them have.
Just a question, that always comes up, and I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate here, and I think I might know the answer to this. But a lot of people say, well, if there's Bigfoot out there, why haven't we found any bones?
Now, we probably have.
You think we have, and we just have misidentified them?
Yeah, well, let's use as an example. And this, obviously, when I try to draw an analogy, all analogies tend to fall short of the facts. So let's not get all of the nitpickers out there taking every last little scrap off the bone, but so to speak.
No pun intended.
The Billy ape, or the Bondo ape, which was recently discovered by Carl Annan in 2004, or confirmed, I should say, was rumored to exist as an African form of Bigfoot known as the Ngulu, that turned out to be a chimpanzee species when the DNA was finally tested, that's larger than a gorilla, has the face of a chimp and tends to walk upright in a swampy area that's somewhat similar in the Congo to the green swamp here in Florida, except for the swamp over in the Congo is as large as the entire state of Florida. This animal turned out to be real. What a lot of people don't realize is based on the genetic work that's recently been done, thanks to our little friend in Mexico, Dominique? I think, or Dominic, who is the Mexican wolf boy. For years they thought that this super hairiness condition known as hypertrichosis was an unusual aberration. For Homo sapiens, it is. For previous species of humans, it wasn't. So when you see all these absolutely clean-shaven reconstructions of ancient men, of relic hominins looking like they dipped into their little travel kit and pulled out an Atra and shaved their face, were running around with a semi not too hairy body, that's BS. They were hairy as hell, and they look like some of the wolf boys that have of circus fame, like JoJo and the others, which coincidentally look a lot like a Bigfoot. These things are well documented. So am I saying that I think Bigfoot is a relic hominin? Probably. And that would mean that some of the skeletons that we're finding are not, we're not going to find anything other than what we are finding.
Well, what I wonder about is there any evidence that, or any theorizing that perhaps they bury their dead?
They may also eat them. There's evidence with the species that was recently uncovered in Grand Dolina, Homo antecessor, I think, is the species name there, that there's butchering marks on the bones suggesting that they ate their fellows.
Mm-hmm.
Not from animals?
No.
But not
tool marks, not like this.
But isn't that kind of relatively rare, Scott? And what I've heard is that, or what I've heard theorized is that Neanderthals did the same thing. Granted, they were a little farther down the evolutionary scale. But I would imagine that those sort of things were isolated to times of famine or climatic changes. Would that be halfway accurate? Would you be inclined to agree with that somewhat?
I wasn't there, so I don't know. The evidence is from some of the bones showing adze marks and things like that, where that, you know, there's been cutting and butchering that was clearly by human. It's very difficult to tell. And let's face it, while we know a lot from what we have in terms of the human family fossil record, if you took all the fossils ever found of a human, they'd fit very comfortably in the back of a pickup truck.
Really?
So you just don't have enough to be able to make sweeping generalizations about what we did and didn't do.
Okay.
We can presume something, and if what makes us comfortable, that's great. But the science is replete with presumptions that have been overturned. So I hear you.
Yeah, if they were hungry, they might have been so inclined. There's no doubt about that.
And, I know there's plenty of stories. Charlie Carlson tells a particularly nice one in his book, Weird Florida, about J.D., a hunter, who he and a friend were out hunting, I think this was the 1940s, shot something that, quote, weren't no bear, went to get their friends, and when they came back, there were drag marks where these things had apparently grabbed onto the one that they shot and killed and dragged it off. Now, I know the skeptics are all going to say, well, we always get that. We don't have the bodies. Yes, I know, folks. But, give these people some credit. Not everybody's a liar.
Yeah, really.
And you really don't have somebody out there claiming they stuck the damn thing in a cooler and froze it in ice.
Well, the other thing is that, you have
to... And they, by the way, were policemen, so should we believe them?
Absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah.
But you know, you have to give credit to any species that can coexist with us and still remain largely, for the most part, unobserved. Yeah, or undiscovered. So
it
must have some level of adult.
Hide is right out in the open.
Yeah, true.
If they come out primarily at night and they are evidently nocturnal, from a distance you really can't tell, and they mm-hmm. seem to have an affinity. For cattle and other large hairy animals that they hang around, and that may be a camouflage effect. In some cases, everybody's by now has heard the story of Zaina, who was the ostensible Almasty or Russian Bigfoot that was captured and lived with the family in the Republic mm-hmm. of what is now the Republic of Georgia back at the turn of the 18th to 19th century, or 19th century to 20th century, excuse me. That wasn't the only case where that type of thing has happened. There's, if you look in Valentine and Orson, there's a legend from the Middle Ages where that's happened. There's stories of feral children going back hundreds and hundreds of years. Some of whom are very hairy. There's the Orford mermaid or merman that really wasn't a merman, it was a Bigfoot. Going back to the very first written story or epic of human existence, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh, and Kidu, if you read very carefully, is a Bigfoot.
What would you surmise as far as the intelligence of Bigfoot?
It's got to be almost as smart as we are, if not smarter in its environment.
Hmm. All right. Here's a question.
It's certainly able to avoid us, so it's got to be pretty swift. It's got to be able to think in advance. It's got to have process of intelligence. Again, assuming that these stories, which all have certain common threads, are true.
But there's a lot of animals that avoid humans.
Sure.
So are we talking tool users?
Probably, although there's very little evidence that they actually do use tools in the sense that other primates do, which kind of bothers me. However, if you look at some of the artwork, which I've done, which depicts these animals coming out of Europe. They apparently certainly had the ability to use and make clubs and other types of tools that appears in the artwork. There are also legends along the Silk Road where these animals, though they could not speak, would come down with things to trade with traders along the Silk Road, and through sign language were able to communicate and affect barter goods and things they wanted. So, you draw your own conclusions.
Here's a question from the chat room. What will happen when, and I might add, if they prove they exist, will they become a protected species? Will they be in danger of poaching?
That would be, both answers are yes. That would be almost automatic. And one of the reasons that I think people who may know the answer, who are in a position to know the answer about these things unequivocally, do not tell anybody.
And who are we talking to or talking about here? Who are you?
Well, I'm not going to reveal that. I'm simply
I don't mean
people out there that know for a fact these things exist. And one of the reasons why they don't go public with it or give us the evidence that we want may very well be because they know full well that the pop gun monkeys are going to want to mount a head on the wall as fast as you possibly can before the government can act and get out of its own way to declare them an endangered species.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's what worries me.
All right, so aside from the stories that you've told us, your experiences, in the field of cryptozoology, what other areas do you find, or other experiences do you find of particular interest that might bear some data on an existence?
I understand the question.
What other areas of cryptozoology do you feel are relevant and
I guess we got to get some semantics down first. And again, having taken the class, I think you've heard me say this already. Most people believe or want to believe that cryptozoology is a search for Nessie and Bigfoot and the Chupacabra and a plethora of the top 10 cryptids. And while those animals certainly figure into the equation, that's not what, in my opinion, cryptozoology is all about. Cryptozoology is about solving riddles. Sometimes a, quote, cryptid is going to turn out to be, as a matter of fact, most of the time, a cryptid is going to turn out to be something we already know about that is either misunderstood, misinterpreted, or out of its normal place.
Okay.
Okay. Other times we're going to be dealing with an animal that is perhaps newly evolved or was missed by the scientific community, and obviously locals will know about it, will talk about it, and that makes it legend, folklore, what have you, and therefore it's a cryptid, and that you have a basic difference. Now, very few people, if anybody other than myself, is running around with the label cryptozoologist, and in which case we are cryptozoologist de jure or in law because we establish ourselves as such. But there are lots of people out there who are in the biological sciences and zoology, et cetera, who are cryptozoologists de facto. Whether they choose to call themselves that, they are cryptozoologists, in fact, because they're doing the things that go along with this branch of the science. When Sanderson and Hoovelman first created the idea years ago, basically they saw it as a branch of zoology that deals with enigmatic animals. And that's pretty much the same way I see it. So you've got a lot of people out there who want to be entertained, and that's all well and good. And if you want to be entertained, folks, how about going to the Everest ride at Disney? Don't go out in the forest with a gun and try to kill something that may or may not be there. You might kill the wrong people. Frankly, my attitude anymore, because there's so many idiots out there that want to hoax, I can't even hold a practicum to take people out into the field and announce where I'm going in advance, because there's going to be a dozen people dressed up in a suit trying to pull a fast one on us. And frankly, I've gotten to the point where I have a individual who is properly trained along with me with a shotgun full of rock salt, and I'll fill your butt full of it so fast it'll make your head swim.
Better cancel your plans, Grant.
Oh, so hey, Scott, though, where's the next coelacanth on the horizon? Do you think any of these cryptids is going to be, you know, like the next coelacanth?
Oh, sure. I have very little doubt that within relatively short period of time, some animals thought to be extinct are going to turn out to be around. I mean, that happened recently with the ivory-billed woodpecker. So now some things are going to be, most things are going to be a lot more recent candidates for, quote, extinction that turn out to be alive than the coelacanth, which ostensibly went out, you know, 65 million years ago and turned out to be paddling merrily off the coast of South Africa and Indonesia. There may be some other things that we're surprised by. We've recently found that giant squid do indeed exist in the deep oceans. Our Japanese friends got some good video. We know they're there. Some of the ostensible animals that lived at about the same time, such as the megalodon, that apparently fed on these things, knowing now that their food source survived, there's no reason to believe they might not have survived.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they wouldn't be seen because of where they would live, at least not frequently.
What about some of the aquatic type creatures, you know, some of the long neck cryptids that, you know, people have thought have been plesiosaurs or something similar? Do you see any
the
of
jury's
those?
Out on that. I'm not sure. You know, does Nessie exist? Well, it may have at one time. Does it still exist? I don't know. Does an elasmosaur or something like it exist off the coast of Florida somewhere? Well, you know, you hear Brian McCleary's story, and you might question that. However, I'm doing some research on that right now, and though I don't actually have the articles in my hot little hands to confirm it, what I've been told by people who have read the articles on microfilm is that the original stories of the five kids who went out and this thing apparently attacked them, four of them died, didn't mention word one about a sea monster until the article came out in Fate magazine sometime later. Then apparently with McCleary under the auspices of a creationist up in the Pensacola area, that probably would not be above creating evidence. Should we give that story credence?
I don't know.
When you think of the sheer depth and size of the ocean, like for a megalodon, yeah, that seems like a real possibility, you know. But for when you start talking about plesiosaurs and some of their cousins and stuff, it seems pretty doubtful. But by the same token, something close or something that seems to have that kind of anatomy seems to keep popping up from time to time. So it's certainly...
Bear in mind, there may be things out there that we just don't know about. Now, even you mentioned the coelacanth, and that's great. But you realize that the coelacanth that's paddling around here today is not the same coelacanth that was paddling around here 65 million years ago.
No, absolutely.
They do evolve, and while it was from the same family of animals, it is not the same animal. Whatever is out there that may still exist would not necessarily be what we're seeing, verbatim, if you will, in the fossil record.
Sure, but there
may be plenty of things out there that we just don't know about.
But essentially, I'll certainly stand to be corrected. But essentially, my understanding is that if, from an evolutionary standpoint, if a certain creature is successful like the coelacanth, then what's the need to evolve other than if the environment dictates so? So any changes that would happen would have to be probably pretty. I absolutely agree with it. It wouldn't be the exact creature, but it's still, from a configuration standpoint, it's not going to change that much.
No, and in the case of the coelacanth, I think that the basic difference is that the upper, the front fins have moved forward in the body over where they were originally, based on what's in the fossil record and that kind of stuff. So, if it serves a purpose, nature does something. But you also have to remember, nature tends to repeat a design that works very well if there's a vacancy in the radial adaptation. In addition to keeping it, I mean, there are some animals, if you go out there and you look in the fossil record, yeah, they're extinct, but, there's another animal alive today that fills the same space, if you will, the same void in the environment, and has a similar appearance.
Yeah, you don't see very many Alamelicharuses or whatever floating around anymore. Those were pretty bizarre creatures.
Yeah. Yeah,
very bizarre.
There are And there are some extremely bizarre creatures. I mean, go down into the depths of the Marianas Trench, and you'll see some things that don't make sense at all.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But, you know, in the world that we inhabit, in the world that they inhabit, the habitat that they inhabit, they make perfect sense.
Yeah. Huh.
All right. So, where do you see the cryptozoology community going? What do you see in the future?
Well, I think ultimately that whether it becomes a science in its own right or is folded into zoology, at some point in time that's going to happen. And the more creatures we discover, the more it's likely to happen. The only hindrance is the black eye that we get from talking about the type that would put on a hoax, particularly the monumental hoax of the last 3 or 4 months, that kind of thing doesn't do anything to give the science credibility. And frankly, if they're listening, fine, you're going to get my opinion. You may not like it. And if you want to come after me, do it. But the bottom line is, I think y'all should be lined up against a wall and shot.
So what do you really mean by that?
What do I really mean by that? I mean, if you want to interpret...
I'm a little unclear here. I'm not sure I quite understand.
No, I think that they should be taken out into the woods, dropped off, and our big hairy friend should have at them.
Well, you know what? It's so lucrative, though. I mean, $250,000?
Yeah, sure, if you bid for your own product, just so you get a little bit more press play out of it.
Well, if eBay finds out about that, that'll be...
They'll act they care.
Well, what's even more amazing, guys, is the fact that somebody sold that suit and possum dinners for, what, $250,000?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's most likely nobody in their right mind paid that. Most likely they bid against their own product and bid it into the...
Oh, I hear what you're saying, yeah.
They get the benefit of that much more play out of the nonsense. Because you got a bunch of P.T. Barnums who think that it don't matter what they say as long as they say something.
Yeah, suckers born every day.
Exactly. Although I don't think Barnum actually said that. But anyway, the bottom line is that's their attitude. And fine. You know, and frankly, I've listened to, Witten and Dyer on some of the radio shows, and they pretty much admitted that that's exactly what they're doing. They want to drum up some business for their ridiculous Bigfoot expedition so they can get away with charging as much as other people do who have big organizations that are trying to get $800 to do a what should be $150-$200 practicum at most and then doesn't even include camping fees and other things. I mean, it's nonsense. It's convoluted ecotourism, and it's dumb.
Now, I'm a little unclear on that one, too. I'm just kidding you. Okay. All right. So, as far as your focus, well, you're obviously very knowledgeable about the field in general. Would it be safe to say that your focus is considerably on Swamp Ape or Bigfoot, or do you have other areas that you really find interesting as well?
Oh, I find almost every cryptid fascinating. I concentrate primarily on the ones that I think are most likely to be proven. Of course, I can't deny the evidence of my own eyes, even though I've still got to be a scientist and approach everything as a skeptic. Well, let me clarify that, too. Skepticism and believing are opposite sides of the same coin. Thank you, Chad Arment.
Yeah.
They're both belief systems. I prefer to remain open-minded without any leaning one way or the other unless I have some sort of valid and reliable, confirmable evidence to say there's something there. Now, people say with Bigfoot there is no evidence there. Well, dermal ridges that don't run the same way as human dermal ridges that are confirmed by an expert in that field, that's pretty significant evidence to me.
You know, Scott, I'd like to pose this to you, get your thoughts on this.
Yeah.
They have, if you've been following the discovery of planets in other solar systems, they have, discovered upwards of 200 planets?
I think so. I think it's something like that now.
And yet they've never directly seen a planet. but they track the star's wobble.
Well, but there's some evidence there. You mentioned the wobble. There's some evidence there that supports that something's going on, and according to the laws of physics as we know them, that you know that acts as confirmation. It's not the same thing in the biological sciences. So you know, I know what you're saying, and yes, things can point to it, and yes, it's an incremental thing. But if you're going to go out there and you're going to hunt a cryptid, okay, you're going to get disappointed more often than not. They wouldn't be cryptids if they were easy to find. So if you want to burn yourself out, go at it. Have fun. Do what you want. But you know, the bottom line is you have to go out there and accumulate evidence. And that brings me to one of the things that I have been decried and called every name in the book and said, you know, people say I'm arrogant about it, yada, yada, yada. But people who don't know how to handle the evidence properly destroy the value of the material they find. And they're doing it all the time. Why do you think we're constantly getting, oh, well, it's inconclusive? Well, it's because you've contaminated the DNA, stupid.
So what are they doing to contaminate it?
Well, they'd pick it up, handle it improperly, put it in the wrong kind of container, expose it to certain types of chemicals that degrade the DNA, yada, 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 and the list goes on. Now, that is not to say that go watch a crime drama on TV, take your little luminol bottle from CSI, breathe deeply, and spray it all over something out in the open. Go ahead and do that, and watch what happens to your lungs. This is not a TV show. The solvents that they use for forensic chemicals are themselves dangerous. The chemicals or the reagents used in most cases are equally dangerous in the hands of an idiot who hasn't been trained to handle them. And, you know, okay, you want to use this stuff, fine, but at least get some training. You know, and if that makes me arrogant because I'm watching out for you and warning you the kinds of damage that you can get into, not you know, for yourself, and then also with the evidence you're trying to work with to prove that there are fingerprints here or that there's been a biological you know, residue that's been left or collect for DNA, whatever it may be, okay, we're losing the value of the evidence, but I don't want to lose a believer either. I don't want to lose somebody who wants to seek the truth either. And if that makes me arrogant, okay, I'm arrogant. But the bottom line is go out and get some training before you try to do these things. And if you want to play the weekend warrior thing, fine. Go find some other animal to chase.
Yeah, a bear.
You know, there's plenty of them out there. You know, some of them are grossly overpopulated. So if you got to find some excuse to go out in the woods and drink and fire your guns off, go find something else.
All right. So
and if you don't like that, you know, I mean, I'm talking to the public out there. If you don't like that, then don't listen to me. You aren't my audience.
All right. So coming back now to circumstantial evidence, tell me, what's the difference between tracking a star's wobble and finding a footprint with dermal ridges that you can't explain?
Well, for one thing, we know that gravity acts in a certain way. We, you know, it follows the rules, at least in our universe. So we know that there has to be something there of a certain mass because you can backtrack all of this, yada, yada. And I'm not an astronomer, so forgive me, folks, if I'm not making this 100% right. But the basic issue is you know there's got to be something there impacting the orbit or producing the wobble or whatever. Or there may be multiple things there. Now, the sheer fact that we have an anomaly in a track, well, you know, first of all, we've got five parallel toes in most of these tracks. That tells us something is an anthropology, you know, physical anthropology issue. That's relatively unequivocal. There's been no example that we know of that causes that exact configuration other than being human. That doesn't mean there's not something else out there that we don't know about.
But they don't match human either.
It simply means that it needs to be fairly closely related, or should be fairly closely related. Now, the fact that it walks on a relatively flat surface compared to our footprints in arches, well, I've seen tracks that have some pretty good arches. I've seen tracks that don't. I've seen some tracks that could be the result of inbreeding, which causes digit problems in the feet. I myself have sarcoarthropy, being a diabetic, which means that the arch on my footprint has fallen. And if you look at my track on my left foot, it looks a lot like a Bigfoot track.
It's smaller.
Okay, it's just smaller. Whereas my right foot, which still has a preserved arch, looks perfectly normal. Does an animal that walks around barefooted in the woods have certain types of problems? Could it have certain types of rheumatoid arthritis? Well, Renee Dahlgren came up with a track that is apparently genuine that shows tumors on the side of the foot and a crooked foot, you know, basically a club foot. Well, looks like they're susceptible, whatever they are, to certain diseases or certain conditions, as are we. Who's to say? Who's to say? Other than there are certain rules that, as anthropologists, we know these animals are going to follow. And if it weren't for that, the very prognostications that Grover Krantz used to say, oh, well, from this jaw mandible that we have and a couple of teeth, I can build a whole skull. And if I can build the whole skull, I can fill in the rest of the animal. And, oh, that's a Gigantopithecus blackie. And, boy, that thing stands this tall, and it's got to be bipedal and yada, yada, yada. Baloney.
Mm-hmm.
I'll point for every anthropologist that'll tell you that thing is bipedal, I can point you to another physical anthropologist that'll say, no way, Jay.
So what? Okay, so you take the footprint with dermal ridges and five toes. Tell me how, now. Factor in the fact that you got hit in the back of the head with a stick, that stones have been thrown. What does that imply?
Well, it implies you got something there. You know, either that, or people are hoaxing things. And you know, if you want to believe that I'm not telling the truth about what happened, well, fine. You know, don't believe me? Go ask Chris. Go ask Chester. They were there. They saw what happened. If three people are not enough for you, well, you know, enjoy your little skeptical bed. Lie in it.
So there's apparently something there. We just haven't identified it.
Well, and there could be other explanations. It wasn't windy that night, so I can't be wind. We can rule that out. I just don't know what else could cause a stick. And now we're talking about a long, thin stick. I'm not talking about a big chunk of wood. I'm talking about a long, thin stick, which hitting me at all was kind of miraculous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Especially from a distance where we couldn't see the animal who chucked it that easily. I don't know what to think. I mean, the thing hit me pretty much like an arrow. It did draw just a little bit of blood, nothing major, but which is how I pretty much knew where it hit, because I could, you know, put my hand back there under the hat, and I pulled it back out and looked with my flashlight. Oh, hey, there's blood there. So it had to hit me hard enough to draw blood. That's not the kind of thing that a relatively small stick is going to do falling out of the canopy.
Right.
So I'm at a loss to explain what happened. And to some degree, you have to go with inverse logic and say, well, if you've eliminated the possible, what you're left with, however improbable, must
mm-hmm.
be real.
Mm-hmm.
One question that comes to mind, Scott, is how do the larger primates, like gorillas, how large of groups do they usually congregate in?
I think there has been documented groups to up to 50 individuals. That's Africa. I don't know that you could extend that across family groups or tribes like the swamp ape or the Bigfoot. They certainly must live in somewhat smaller groups. The individual groups tend to stick around 20 in terms of the larger of the apes. And even that might be a little bit high. I mean, basically, the structure is patriarchal. There's one silverback. The second, another male reaches sexual maturity in the group, they're chased off, and they become a lone male that is expected to set up their own troop. And if you're going to follow that model, which I think probably explains, you know, the Bigfoot-type populations, we're probably looking at 12, maybe 15 animals. At most, the majority of which are not going to be fully grown.
And a lot of times, some people have actually witnessed, and this is coming from a question in the chat room from Sharon, that there are juveniles, and they have found juvenile prints as well, have they not?
Oh, yeah. I've got two juvenile prints sitting next to me in a box here by my office now that were sent to me by Chester Moore. Mm-hmm. And we saw similar tracks in Texas where he took me. there have been reports of hunters in the Green Swamp here of, quote, chimpanzees loose in certain areas of the Green Swamp. Well, are they? You know, when I call the Department of Wildlife, I try to find out if there's any known primates running around loose in there. I get a report back negative. That doesn't necessarily mean that they haven't. You know, that there hasn't been an escape or somebody had an exotic that got away, yada, yada, yada. But on the other hand, you know, that's as good an explanation as any. You know, maybe they're mini Bigfoots or mini swamp apes. So, you know, I just don't know. You know, let me see them, and it's a different story. Then I can pretty much tell you what I'm seeing. You know, I mean, you know, Tom Biscardi had a tape last year that, you know, they were running around with, and I went on his show after having seen it and was asked my opinion, and even though the thing was extremely dark and virtually unreadable and had been clarified enough that I could see motion, I knew what I was looking at, and I told him, you know, point blank to his face, those are chimps. I mean, I know the behavior. I know what they're going to do. I know chimp language. I know their gestures and their movements, and what I saw was chimps.
So we've just got a few minutes left here. What message do you want to send to the field? What?
I think we've covered it.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if you're wanting to go out there and you want to be quote a cryptozoologist, or you want to at least practice cryptozoology, go out there and get some education as to how to properly apply forensics to the profession or to the work you're doing. Collect things properly, put them in the hands of the correct people to do the testing, most of which cannot be done out in the field properly. Keep a proper chain of custody, which is something we haven't yet covered in the class, I think is next week, Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, there's a record of who handled it, when they handled it, who you sent it to, when it's due back. That's called a chain of custody. Because you need all of those things, because if you come up with anything that's really usable, if you don't do it the right way, the skeptics will be all over it, and it's useless.
So let's talk about getting training. Now, I've been taking your class over the last 8 weeks or so, and it's been very, very good. So talk about where people can...
Well, I'm not the only one. I was the first one to get it, you know, as a regular college class, albeit non-credit, and there was a reason for that. But Harrison Demchek did it at Oberon, and they, you know, he more approached it from a survey of cryptid animals kind of thing, and you know, because it was an experimental class, it didn't continue. He was a graduate student. There's a class, I think, at Stanford now that's looking at it from a myth and legend perspective, and several other, you know, classes have cropped up since. I'll be doing one on Bigfoot animals or bipedal hairy primate ape type animals that have appeared in art history going back to the Stone Age for Florida Keys Community College this spring. You need to get out there, and whether you take it as a cryptozoology class, which I think is good background for someone, so you really know what the business or field's all about, or you take individual classes in criminal science that involve using forensic reagents or something like that, that's fine. But get the training. Get the training.
And
if you're going to go out there and really try to do this thing justice, you have to have that.
And I'm going to recommend that you all go to Pangea Institute. Give the web address, Pangea-Institute, or Academy, rather. I apologize for that. Pangea Academy.
You're right, because the Academy is run by the Institute, so you're right.
Right. Okay. So, Pangea, give the website. Give all your contact.
It's www.pangea, P-A-N-G-E-A, like the one continent from back in the dinosaur era, -academy.org takes you to our classroom setup. And then the institute is Pangea Institute, all spelled out and run together, .us,
right.
United States, not .com. And you know, that will take you to the Academy and the Institute with both those websites, and you can keep up on the things that we're doing, which includes field excursions. We don't just do cryptozoology. We do paleontology. We do extinction studies. We do marine science type things. We take out fossil hunting, and there's a plethora of different things, about 200 different events we do. In different areas, and that's all available on the website for you to look at, and we're always adding classes.
And what books do you have available?
Well, the only book I have in print right now is a chapter in Elementum Bestia. That's Elementum Bestia. It's available from lulu.com in the medical science area. It deals with Bigfoot and art history. It's also available in the Pangea bookstore. Now I do have another book that I'm about to complete, I hope, this year, if things don't change dramatically, called The Community of Legendary Bigfoot, in which I detail a theory, if you will, of how the swamp ape Bigfoot and these other creatures could have survived or could have evolved. And that's a fascinating read. It's very heavily illustrated, and my points are documented and properly cited, and the whole shoot match there.
Yeah, sounds good.
So it's not really a fantasy book; it's a scientific book. And you know, some people say I write like Milton. Well, you know, if you don't mind being bored to death, you know, I think he was a bit full of himself, and there's a lot of people out there think so. But you know.
All right, great, very good.
Good one, Scott. I like that.
Yeah, interesting stuff. All right, for our listeners and our archive listeners, we're going to make some changes to Paranexus Universe. We're going to, by and large, be sticking to an hour program from here on out. There might be occasions when we'll extend that a little bit, but that's what we're going to do, and make it a little bit shorter and get some good points in there. We'd like to encourage anybody who's not to take a look at Paranexus.org, become a member. We've got a number of things going on there. The Paranexus Academy launched, the Paranexus Registry. We'd love to have you come and join us and get in this field. And we're really looking for those who are serious about it, too, serious researchers. So take a look at Paranexus.org. We will be announcing our guest for next week in the newsletter coming up. We haven't got that solidified yet. We do have Robbie Thomas coming up in November. We've also got Ed Kraft scheduled now for November 20th. And if you're not familiar with him, he's very, very knowledgeable and experienced in the paranormal field, so we'll be talking with Ed then. Until next week, we really appreciate your time. We appreciate your questions. And Scott, thanks so much for taking your time to join us tonight. We appreciate that.
Anytime, Doug and Grant, not a problem, and I appreciate it. And you know, I hope I wasn't too intense for everybody tonight.
Hey. A real pleasure, Scott.
Great pleasure talking to you all.
Yeah, and you have a great night, and everybody else, take care of yourself. We'll see you next week.
Good take night, care, Scott. Everyone.
Paranexus Universe.